This is the Improve Photography Podcast, episode number 89. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, use offer code IMPROVE at checkout. A better web starts with your website. Hey everybody, and welcome back to the Improve Photography Podcast. I am Jim Harmer, and today I am so excited to be back with you because I have been on a whirlwind tour shooting in three states with four multi-day shoots. It was just crazy. So today you are joined by thousands of photographers from all around the world. And today we're going to talk about a lot of the things that I learned or realized over the last couple days of this whirlwind shoot. And to talk about it all, I'm joined by my friend Darren Meller.
Hey, Jim, how are you? Are you finally catching up with the time zone that you're in right now, or are you ready to move on to the next?
I am so jet lagged. I've just been exhausted all day, but I'm excited to be here and talking photography. And you've been shooting a lot, too. I've been following you on Facebook, and I've been seeing a lot of stuff.
Yeah, I've been capturing fall color here locally, photographing different opportunities like horses out in the pasture at perfect night, or perfect lighting during the magic hour, and just staying within relatively the state of Iowa and Nebraska and just shooting and just not letting that trigger finger get lazy.
Yeah, that's good. Well, we already recorded this episode just a little bit ago, and we were going to hit over an hour, and we said, okay, let's re-record this and let's break it into two pieces so it's more consumable. I know a lot of you listen to the podcast as you are commuting or exercising, and well, that's a lot of commuting and exercising. So we're going to split it up into two. In this episode, we're going to talk about some of the things I learned in portrait photography over the last week. And in the next episode, we're going to talk more about the landscape and nature stuff that I've been shooting, and also Darren as well, just some of the things we've been learning. We have a list here of over 40 tips that we've learned just in the last week, just things that I've realized and have really sunk home. So let's get started and talk about as many of these as we possibly can. All right.
Awesome. I'm excited.
Yeah. So the first shoot that I did, the first portrait shoot, was my family photos, me, my wife, and my two little boys. We were in Portland, and I did a lot of landscape and nature photography while we were there. That's kind of why we went. But the family came along, and we made it a family trip as well. And taking your own family picture is tough. First of all, family photos are just tough in general because you have to have, you know, like five people looking at the camera and smiling at the same time. That's already hard enough. And then you have to pose multiple people. It's a real challenge to do family photography, and even tougher when you're doing it yourself. So it was a real challenge. One thing that I did that helped with that is usually, you know, you set the 10-second timer and you sprint into the end of the photo. Well, there are a couple different ways you can fix that. One is if you have the Yongnuo flash triggers, you can just put one on the camera and use the little cord that comes with it to go from the flash trigger onto or into the cord into the port on the side of your camera, and you can hold another one in your pocket and just click it, and that'll take the picture. You can do the same thing with trigger trap. Trigger trap's only like $20 or $30. We talked about on a podcast last week. It is such a good deal. That would fix it. But the way that I did it, that I'm really happy with, that I liked, so I didn't have to hold anything in the pictures, is I just set the interval timer on the camera like you're taking a time lapse. So every 5 seconds, click, it would flash the fire, flash the flashes, and take the picture. And so with my two little boys, especially my little 3-year-old who will just never look at the camera, it was perfect because it would just shot, and eventually one of them would get him. And then it's pretty easy to mask them together in Photoshop when you're on a tripod and everything's locked down. So that was really helpful. Have you done anything like that, Darren?
No, I haven't. And I've always appreciated the angles that you did. The Harmers looked really great. And I like the angle where it was looking down at the four of you. And so is that the same setup you used with the tripod and just had everyone try to get in place and then use Photoshop to put everyone in there correctly? Or did you use a different technique for that?
Yeah, that exact same thing. In fact, we can link to those family photos on the podcast show notes. So go to improvephotography.com/89 and we'll have a link to those photos. You know, the photos came out nice. It was nice to get, you know, family photos. I wouldn't say they're world class or anything amazing or anything, but that really, really helped to get the shot. The conditions were just beautiful in Oregon. So one thing that helped the photos to turn out cool is my wife picked our clothes for it. She still dresses me. And since everything's such so luscious green in the forest, she wore a bright red shirt. And that contrast of the green and red, and the little boys had a little bit of green or red in their shirts as well, I think really popped and really made the photos look good. So definitely something to think about as you're planning photos or clothes for a family photo shoot is what colors will contrast well with the background. And so that really helped a lot.
Oh yeah.
So as we shot those family photos and I had to bribe my kids with $1 if they were good during the end of the shoot, and they were awesome. I came back to Boise and I had scheduled for many weeks that I think I've mentioned on the podcast before, a photo shoot with an Olympic gold medalist in swimming, Bria Larson. And it was, a big shoot. I put a lot of background time into that shoot to really be ready and make sure I could take advantage of that opportunity that I had. So I had my phone full of photos that I found on Pinterest and on Google, just not necessarily even photos that I wanted to replicate or even do anything similar to. What I was looking for is just photos of swimmers, even if it was just an amateur photo. And I was looking for what poses and positions the swimmers were in that I thought would look good in a photo. And I'm so glad I did that, because when we started the shoot, I immediately started shooting some safe shots. You know, pictures of her posing dry next to the pool with a gold medal and smiling. Just kind of quick grab me shots. And you know, okay, good, I got a couple background shots. But the reason that I always do that when I do a portrait session is start with the quick, easy stuff, is that you're able to analyze the person that you're shooting. You're able to see what their body's like, if they feel awkward, if you need to loosen them up. And usually I'm chatting with them. I'm saying, hey, just relax. I'm just setting up the flashes. And I'm able to see, you know, what smile is most natural. Is it a smile with no teeth, a big old grin with teeth, laughing, you know, where they look the best. And as I was shooting with Bria, the first thing that I noticed is, I mean, she is incredibly muscular. I mean, you'd expect it from an Olympian, right? But I mean, it was just so impressive. Any guy would be envious of the muscles. I mean, she is just incredible. And as we're shooting, I thought, okay, it doesn't matter what we do. My main goal in this shoot is to show off just her incredible physique for the sport that she's chosen. And so after we got those safe shots, I said, all right, let's take 5. And I sat down, I opened up my iPhone, and I started flipping through those photos that I had saved. And I found one where somebody was just diving into the water. And as I saw that shot, I saw how their shoulders were contracted. And I thought, perfect. You know, this is going to show off her muscles just right. Just incredible arm strength. And so I got into the water on the other side of the pool with a 70 to 200 millimeter lens, and I was shooting at 200 millimeters, and the water was up to my shoulders shooting, and I was shooting across the pool at her, and the lens was just literally, I mean, just barely above the water level, because I wanted that unique perspective of jumping into the water, wanted to look action-packed shooting up at her. And I went good. I scooted in a little bit tighter, and there was quite a bit of spray when she was jumping into the water, you know, just a little bit of a splash. And I was pretty far back that, you know, the water wasn't really reaching me. But just in case, I got the underwater housing for my camera. I'm using an Ewa Marine underwater bag. It's about $400, and I've used it in Hawaii, used it on this shoot, used it lots of times before. You're scared when you put your DSLR in this thing, like, is this going to protect my camera going underwater? But I've never had a drop of water using this thing. It's really well built, and I definitely recommend it. But I made a little mistake. I had the flash transmitter on, and I had never used this underwater bag with the flash transmitter, and it didn't fit with the flash transmitter on. So I kept the top of the bag open so that I could fit the flash transmitter on my hot shoe. And I thought, ah, no big deal. I really don't even need the bag anyway, but just in case there was a little splash, you know, just to be careful. Well, she jumps in the water another time, and just this little tiny bit of water, like the amount that you could fit in one of those old film canisters, you know, the black canisters with the gray lids, remember those? Oh, yeah. Those little film canisters, just a tiny bit of water, that much, came over and in the bag, and I thought, eh, I didn't even think anything of it. I mean, I've used my D800 and D810 out in just downpours of rain in Costa Rica. Never had trouble. I mean, this was just a tiny bit of water. Something happened with the way that it hit the camera, rolled in, whatever. Maybe it was that once the water got in there, it was trapped in the bag. I don't know what it was, but the camera just all of a sudden said error on the top LCD. And I thought, oh no. Oh. At first I thought it was a corrupted memory card because it was such a little bit of water that I just didn't even think anything of it. I thought, oh no, my memory card's corrupted. No big deal. I'll switch. Tried a new memory card. Huh? Nothing. I tried reattaching the lens, see if it was a lens communication error. Nothing. And all of a sudden, thump, camera goes completely black, will not turn on. And I realized it was the water.
Oh, no.
And I panicked because just that morning, I saw my backup camera, my D800, on the table. And I thought, nah, I don't need it. You'll remember from a couple podcasts ago that the LCD screen broke. It didn't even get cracked. It was in my bag. I just took it out and the LCD just wouldn't work anymore. Strange. Anyway, so the LCD wasn't working. I thought, I'm just going to leave it. I've only once ever needed a backup camera before. Well, boy, did I regret that at this moment. And I was stressing it. But I had hired two photo assistants to come with me, and my wife also came. I like having my wife on the shoot. She really helps with the photo assistants that we can talk about a little bit later. But one of the assistants that came had his camera bag in the car, and he was nice enough. Jeff Stiles, I'll give him a shout out. We should link to him on the show notes. Great photographer here in Boise. He had his camera bag, and so he let me borrow his 5D Mark III for the rest of the shoot. And whew, I mean, I was sweating bullets, but it took about, you know, 25 minutes out of the shoot by the time we got the camera, you know, troubleshot the old camera, got the new camera out there, got the flashes to sync with it, everything. And so, you know, it was a 1 hour shoot, and we were already 45 minutes in once we were at this point. I got like 5 or 6 photos of her diving into the pool, a couple safe shots, and that was it. And I only had 15 minutes left. I thought, there's no way. I put so much work into preparing. There's no way that it has gone into such a disaster. But we were able to get things together, and we did take a couple other shots. But I moved on from the diving pose because I thought, you know, if this didn't work, I got to have something. And so I moved on and shot a couple other shots that turned out fine. But when I got back to the computer, there was no question. It was the diving shot that was cool. And so that's the one that I really wanted to turn out. So I looked at it, and I had, you know, 5 or 6 shots. The first photo was just black because where I had my assistants holding the flashes, she dove way further than I had anticipated. She was, you know, obviously pretty good. And so she dove way further than I had anticipated, and it was just black. She just missed the lights. And then in the subsequent photos, you know, I got one photo of her arms outstretched, which is perfect. Muscles looked awesome. But her lower back was bent still. Wasn't good. Another photo where her leg was kicked up. Perfect. But the other one wasn't. And I looked at the 6 shots and I said, you know what? In each one of these shots, part of her body looks perfect. And so I spent 6 hours in Photoshop putting together the different parts of the body that looked good in each of the shots. I was glad that the lighting and the composition was the same. It was just different parts of the body that I needed to put in there. I would have loved to have shot it, you know, 10 more times as I normally would have and try to get as much of it right in camera as possible. But, you know, as I mentioned, it just wasn't happening. I was desperate. There were 15 minutes left with all the camera trouble we had. And so this was a situation where getting it right in camera really wasn't one of the options. The option was, let's put this thing together. And so I was really glad that I've developed the skills in Photoshop over time that I could do something like that, because I put it up online and on Pixoto, and it was one of the most popular photos that I've ever taken. In fact, it was kind of funny. Bria told me the next day, she said, hey, I saw that photo you put up on Twitter, and I saw another photographer took credit for taking the photo within like 20 minutes.
Oh, wow.
Who are these people who sit around online and when they see photos, they post it themselves and say they took it? Who are those people? It was crazy.
Wow, but anyway, that's nuts.
I was really happy with how the photos turned out. One of my favorite photos that I've ever taken. And I guess knowing the story behind it even makes it more cool to me. But I'm telling you all this not just for story, but in photography, it's really about having experience. A lot of you are new in photography. Some are more experienced, but every time you have a shoot like this that goes into disaster mode, you learn one more way to protect yourself from making it happen again. Whether it's that big shoot with an Olympic gold medalist or the shoot with the 16-year-olds who's paying you $100 for a senior picture, the more experience you have, the more you can avoid problems in your photos. And so that's why I share this story with you, is it gives you experience without the negative aspects of going through what I did. But all ended well with some good pictures out of the shoot.
And it also makes me feel a little bit less like a dork taking my spare camera with me, because you never know, I might need it sometime, right?
Yeah, that's definitely true. You always want to have a plan B. In fact, that's the main lesson that I learned over these portrait shoots. More plan Bs that were necessary in the next shot that we'll talk about in just a second. But before we get to that, we want to take a second and thank our sponsors. The first person who makes this podcast possible is Squarespace.
Yes, Squarespace is the all-in-one platform that makes it fast, easy, and simple to create your own personal, professional websites, portfolios, and online stores. It is so simple and easy to use. It has a beautiful design for photographers. You can just drag and drop content, and they have awesome 24/7 support through live chat and email, and they're located both in New York City and in Dublin, Ireland. It's an amazing deal because the plan starts out at $8 a month and includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. So start your trial at free trial at Squarespace. And once your trial is expired, remember to use the 10% off code, which is IMPROVE at checkout. A better web starts with your website.
Yeah, Squarespace is awesome. And in the past, I have been really slow to update my website because it was kind of a pain to do everything. Now with my Squarespace site, it's the easiest platform I've used. And I've tried a lot of them for just quick updates. I mean, there's nothing to mess with. I can get in there, update it with the photos of the Olympic swimmer and the photos of West Virginia that I got with the travel group, and boom, it's done. It looks beautiful. It's really easy to use. I love it. I'm very happy with Squarespace. Another sponsor of the Improved Photography Podcast is Swirl, S-W-O-R-L. Swirl is a free app that you can get on your phone, and what it allows you to do is it's available on the iPhone. You get the free app, and then when you take a photo that you want to print off, boom, you just click it and bang, they're going to ship you a really nicely framed photo that you can hang on your wall or put on your desk. I got one that I have on my desk right next to my computer monitor of me and my boys out on the boat. And it's really fun to be able to do that. We used to print photos all the time when it was back in the film days, because you had to have some way for that medium to live. But now that everything's digital, a lot of times we skip printing those really fun, important family photos or your serious photography because we do have it online. And, you know, I've had this photo on my desk, and every time I look at it, I always think about the kids and the times we had. I think it's a fun app to have, especially over the holidays coming up, Thanksgiving in the United States and Christmas coming up. It's so easy to order a photo, you know, as you're visiting somebody for the holidays, take a couple nice photos with them, and just in a couple clicks, you got a photo, a nicely framed photo. It comes actually really beautifully wrapped in wrapping paper that you can give as a gift to somebody right from your iPhone. It's pretty, pretty neat. You can try Swirl Framing app and get 20% off your first order by using the promo code IMPROVE, and their website is getswirl.com. Swirl is S-W-O-R-L, or you can always go to improvephotography.com/89, and we'll have a link there in the show notes.
Yeah, it seems like a very awesome app, and there's just a bunch of probably ingenuitive ways where you could surprise and delight upcoming clients by having a package waiting for them at their doorstep with a photo that you just shot with your iPhone. So I think that would be really neat to start out with.
Yeah, it's very cool. Well, as I was taking the pictures of the swimmer, there were a couple cool things that I did with flash. First of all, even on the big shoots, I still use the cheap $70 YN560s. I've tried the more expensive flashes. I used to have a $2,500 really nice studio strobe setup with four different strobes and battery packs and huge octobanks and everything. And now I just use my little tiny little YN560s, and they get the job done. I always hear people saying, oh, well, I shoot sports, I need high-speed sync. And there's an argument for that. There are definitely times where it works. When I was in Colorado Springs and we were shooting the motorsports, it really was helpful to have that to shoot the dirt bikes because it was natural light. In this shoot, however, with a swimmer, it was, ugly lights. We were shooting in a YMCA. I just called the YMCA and I said, hey, we got an Olympian coming. Can you support him by allowing us to shoot? And it was funny when we got into the pool, by the way. Bria was getting ready to dive and stuff. And the lifeguard was looking at us because we were in the no diving zone. It wasn't real shallow, but it was a little bit shallower. And the lifeguard was, and I came over to the lifeguard and I said, hey, I don't think she's going to drown. I think she can swim better than all of us. I think she's going to be just fine. I was a little bit worried about the liability of, great, you're the one who killed the Olympian. Awesome. But no, she said, oh no, when I dive in, I really barely go under the water. Anyway, so when we're shooting in an area like that, it was in a YMCA, it was ugly, fluorescent lighting and a busy background. So what I did is I turned the flash power up to full power on the two flashes that I was using. And then I adjusted my camera settings to shoot really, really dark. Adjusted up the aperture to F11, F12 or something, and ISO 64 on my D810, which is the native ISO, and a shutter speed of 1/200th of a second. Now, with those settings, it produces a completely black picture with no flash. So that ugly stuff in the YMCA is gone. You can't see it. It's black. And then the way that I expose the picture is just with a flash, by having a lot of flash power. So you can see her, lit up beautifully, a nice spot of light in the water, but then the background goes to a rich black. And contrasting with the blue water of the pool splashing up, man, it looks good. That lighting style is just awesome. So, but you can use this technique anywhere. If you're, shooting a picture of somebody at a birthday party and you think, oh, this would be kind of cool, want to try something, just pop up your flash power super, super high, and you can make it look like you're shooting in a studio on a black background. And we have an article on improved photography that explains how to do that, how to, shoot on a black background minus the black background by just using the flash. That's really, really neat. Have you done that before, Darren?
I have not, but I've started messing around with doing different flash techniques, and I actually tried it after rewatching one of the videos. When I was a student of yours, I definitely took the lesson in stride, but now that I have four YN560 flashes, my dad and I did some test shots, and it's really cool because right now, to be honest, our basement's torn up. We had some people do some repair on the foundation, and it is not looking good. It's where our studio usually is, and we just blasted the flash in the background and made it black, so you can't see any of the steel beams and studs that they did down there. So it works out really well, but it's going to take a little bit of time to figure out the technique because I don't think my flash power was high enough, and then we also had some ambient light coming in from a window, so we'll get it figured out.
Yeah, it takes some practice. The trick is you can't have too much flash. The more flash you have, the blacker the background gets. And another thing is you got to make sure that none of your flash is spilling onto the background. So I had the two flashes that I was using or had my assistants holding were in soft boxes. And so, it was keeping it off the background. It was only shooting onto where she was, and the flashes were in pretty close to her. If you turn the flash a little bit and the flash hits the background, well, yeah, then it's going to show up in the picture because it's exposed as well. Well, after I shot a little bit in with the swimmer, and it took me 6 hours in Photoshop to put everything together with that swimmer. It was quite the Photoshop job, but I think the resulting photo turned out really, really cool. I was happy with it. One thing that I noticed as I was Photoshopping the photo is that in 6 hours in Photoshop, I used the clone tool once for 30 whole seconds. And it really made me think that Photoshop has changed dramatically in CS5 and CS6 that have that content-aware fill. Because what I used to use the clone tool for every day in editing photos, I rarely use anymore. It's an important tool, and sometimes it's just the right one, but I find myself more, every time I would use the clone tool, I just quick select it with the lasso tool and hit Shift F5, and it just fills it with content aware, and it just looks really, really cool. So for those of you who are newer to Photoshop, the clone tool allows you to copy from one spot on the photo and paste it on another. So let's say we have the grass on your lawn and a piece of trash there, and we want to get rid of the piece of trash. Well, I Alt-click on the grass, and then I click on the trash, and it fills in the grass where I copied from onto the trash. And I used to use this all the time in Photoshop. It was my most used tool to just clone out little tiny things. But now with Content Aware Fill, I'm finding it easier and better results to just quick grab the lasso tool and quick select that area. And then Content Aware Fill, it just uses an algorithm to guess what should be there by what's around it, and it fills it with grass on that spot. And so I just thought that was interesting, I guess, that Photoshop really has changed majorly just by adding that Content Aware Fill tool. I'm using it a lot. Are you using Content Aware Fill a lot, or are you still using Clone Tool?
I'm the same. I'm using the clone tool for certain situations, but I would say that I'd use Content Aware Fill for the most of my photos, and then I also use the healing tool as well for even smaller spots, especially sensor dust and trying to go along an outline of something that is just a quick and dirty fix. But yeah, Content Aware Fill with the Magic Lasso, that is my go-to trick when it comes to fixing things inside Photoshop.
Yeah, I really love it. I think it works very, very well. Now, on the shoot with the Olympian, I mentioned that I had two assistants and my wife was there. I love it when my wife can come along for a shoot when we can get a babysitter for the boys, because she's helped me with enough shoots that she knows kind of some of my personal things that I like in a shoot. And so a lot of times I'll get an assistant that hasn't shot with me before, and they'll hold the flash in a spot and their arm starts getting tired and it starts drifting down, 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 and it changes the light. And so I got to, no, keep the flash up, you know, just little things like that. And so it's really nice that my wife was able to come, because she kind of coached the assistants on some of the spots on things that she knows that I like. I want to make a note about hiring assistants. I always get feedback on lessons on photoclasses.com, on things I post on Facebook, of people saying, oh yeah, sure, that's great for you that you can use three flashes. There's no way I could afford to have an assistant at my shoots. My shoots are just little things in the park. That's not an excuse. Hiring an assistant is easy. All I did is I did this, the tip that I shared a couple episodes ago, with just starting a Facebook group and call it, you know, the Austin, Texas Photography Lovers, or the, you know, Georgia Photography Lovers, or the Calgary, Alberta, Canada Photography Lovers. And then just add a couple people, you know, who you like, who like photography in your city. And then I have an awesome built-in network right there of photographers anytime I need some help. And it was just made a huge, huge difference in the shoot. All I did is post on there and say, hey, I'm paying $20 an hour, come and help. And I'll go out and assist for other guys too, just to be nice, to be helpful with their shoots. In fact, I did it, a week or two ago. A guy was posted on that group and said, hey, I need an assistant. And it was only $15. It wasn't worth my time to go over there. But I wanted to network. I wanted to see how other photographers work and things. So I went over just on a lunch hour and quick helped him out. And it's an awesome experience. I really like doing it. And it really helps to have photography friends around, especially in a shoot like this where my camera died and I needed to have an assistant there who brought a camera bag and saved me. And then the next day when I shot engagements with Bria and her fiance, it was awesome. I had an assistant as well. And I find that I shoot much less lazy when I have an assistant. When you don't shoot with an assistant, you use flash less often, because you say, oh man, I can't lug around the flash in a flash stand and be messing with it, or else I don't get enough shots. Or, you know, you see a little hair come over the model and you think, I'm already messing with the flash and the camera, I can't do that too. just having another set of hands is so helpful. So, you know, beg your best friend to come along. You know, if you have a teenage son or daughter, just bring them, you know, pay somebody on a Facebook group, do what you got to do. But just have somebody along to help you with those little things. They don't even have to be a photographer. Just somebody to help with those little things can make a huge difference. And it was a lifesaver in this shoot.
Oh, it was. I mean, having that backup camera that you didn't bring along with you, that was a lifesaver. And also working with someone who can definitely have a fresh set of eyes look at things and say, yeah, that hair's over someone's face. Or, you know, maybe if you move the flash a little bit this way, if they're a photographer, it's great. If they're not, you know, they won't be as helpful in some respects. But if they are, they can definitely clue you into how to pose. And they can even help you possibly if you join one of those Facebook groups. You can say, oh, well, I'm having so much trouble removing this rosacea off someone's face. Usually, a lot of people in those groups are very, very down to earth, and they'll help you out in a lot of respects. So you really just can't give anything away. And also, when it comes down to it, when you have these photographers as assistants, you build that relationship and that rapport to where they're going to want to reach out with questions to you. And then also they're very accepting when you have questions for them.
It's great for networking and great for your photos, that's for sure.
Yes.
Well, the next day, I mentioned that I shot Bria's engagements. I shot sports shoot over the night before, and then I shot her engagements. And I got everything ready, got it all packed in bags, ready to go, put it in the car. I got to the shoot location half an hour early so I could scout it out, see exactly where I was going to pose, wanted to be totally ready. I double-checked my gear to make sure I had everything packed in my bags that I wanted. And then I pulled out my camera about 5 minutes before she was going to arrive. And I only had one of my photo bags. I had another bag that I left outside downstairs next to the door. I just forgot it. And I panicked again. I thought, no way. Yesterday, my camera died halfway through the shoot. And so I'm on my backup camera, and the LCD screen broke on my camera a couple weeks ago that I mentioned in the podcast. I have no idea how. It's not even cracked, just broke. And I was glad I had it to do this shoot, because there wasn't enough time to get another one shipped to me. And so I was shooting on my backup. I thought about borrowing one from a friend. And I thought, it's all right. I'm just going to shoot dark. It's like shooting film, you know. You don't get to see the photo right away. But I thought, I've done enough portraits. This is going to be fine. And it was. But I only had one photo bag. And in that other photo bag were some very important pieces of gear. One, my softbox. I only had an umbrella to shoot with, which was fine. Not a big deal, especially for shooting outdoors. But also my flash transmitter. And I thought, oh no, if I don't have a flash transmitter, I am toast. And there was not enough time to run back and get it. And so I was fortunate that I had at least one flash in the bag, and I searched through my car and I thought, oh, come on, I have flashes everywhere. I've got to have one more. And I did. Under the seats, I found another flash. And so I had two flashes. So the way that I triggered my flash is I set one camera on the hot shoe to just fire as soon as I press the trigger. Or the shutter button, and I turned the flash head to face my assistant who was holding the main flash that would actually light the couple, and I set the second flash that my assistant was holding on slave mode, so it fires. Slave mode means that it fires when it sees that pop of light from any other flash. So it was you know, kind of a chain reaction. My camera would trigger the flash on the hot shoe, and that camera would shoot a light over to the main flash, and then the maiden flash would light the couple. It was a crazy rig, but it absolutely worked. It won't work if you don't point the main the on-camera flash at the main flash, because it won't be enough light in ambient light, you know, when you're outdoors. But this rig worked great. It actually fired every single time I wanted to, which I was glad about. But it was another lesson to me that if you're going to be shooting professional photography, it's so important to not get in a rut. You know, if you're just used to always seeing your photo right on the LCD, if you only know one way to trigger your flash, eventually you're going to get stuck, because plan Bs are necessary in photography. Stuff happens on shoots. And I was so glad that I had known those couple of techniques to save me in a situation like that. It was scary, but it turned out just fine.
Yeah, it seems like Jim Harmer is going from photography nerd to photography MacGyver, so that's pretty funny.
I wish. Then I could make a 5D Mark III out of rubber bands and a paper clip.
I would like to see that.
Anyway, so it turned out okay. Shooting blind was actually kind of cool. It was, you know, obviously something I haven't done in a long time, since we always have that quick fix of seeing the photo, but it kind of did help me to focus on the shoot and things. And as I looked at the photos after the shoot, they were fine. You know, I didn't need to be staring at the photos all the time, except for one thing. I made a mistake, kind of a big mistake on the shoot that I had never faced before. So when you're shooting a couple, you have to be really careful with depth of field. If one person's face is a little bit in front of or behind the other, the plane of focus, the sharp part, is too narrow, and one face is blurry and the other one's sharp, because you're shooting with shallow depth of field to have a nice creamy blurry background. Well, when you're shooting an engagement, it's really important to make sure that both faces are equal to each other. So during the whole shoot, you know, I'm always very careful to say, you know, Taylor, scoot your head just a little bit forward, a little bit back, so that your eyes are on an equal plane, and so we can get that shallow depth of field. Well, so I did that, of course. But then after I looked at the photos afterward, I realized I made a mistake, that the groom-to-be has facial hair. And it was a real problem, because I was shooting at f2.8 almost the whole time, especially when it was dim. And so his eyes were sharp and her eyes were sharp, but you let the skin just go a little bit soft when you're shooting that wide open. And with his facial hair, it really made the photo look a little bit blurry, because it was soft and there was so much detail there in the hair that it felt like it should be sharper. And so I had to throw away some of the photos from the shoot that really just didn't look good. It was a lesson to me. I'd never faced that situation before, but if you're shooting somebody with facial hair, you may want to stop down just slightly so you got their eye and their facial hair in sharp focus.
Yeah, it's a good way to not let things get hairy.
Oh, you've been waiting on that one for the whole story, huh?
Oh, yeah.
Another thing that I did that I do usually when I'm shooting portraits is I back up between setups. So if you shoot at one location, then I went to a different park across the way to get a little bit of a different look. And when I jumped in the car, I just quick grabbed out my memory card and stuck it in my laptop that I had sitting in shotgun. And I just had the photos importing into Lightroom. Then just in case anything wild happens, and enough wild stuff had happened that I decided I'd do it, I had a backup, you know, two times during the shoot, just in case something happened. So that's another thing to do. Another just quick thought is, I really wish I had an 85mm f1.8 lens. They're not terribly expensive for Canon or Nikon, but it's a nice lens. It's a great portrait lens. But sometimes I found that f2.8 was just not enough as it was getting really dim. We started at 4 p.m. and shot until dark, and some of those dark shots really just didn't have quite enough light on them. It was cheating down to like 1/30th, 1/25th of a second, and it wasn't the best. And so I think I'm going to have to pick up an 85mm f1.8, mostly just for that situation, those later time portraits. I think it'd be a nice lens to have.
Yeah, because at face value, it doesn't really seem like it'd be a big difference between f2.8 to f1.8. But as far as allowing light in there to allow us to have that faster shutter speed, to remove camera shake or the models moving at all, it's really important to have that faster aperture, especially in the situation you were in.
Yeah, it's a lot of light between f1.8 and f2.8.
Oh, for sure.
Well, that's a lot. We learned a lot in the last week shooting portraits, but in every episode, we want to share a doodad with you, some cool resource or tool that we found that's helpful for our photography. And one that I want to share with you is a paint pole adapter. This is awesome. I'm using it in two different ways. So you can get an extension pole that, you know, you can use to clean windows that are high in your house or paint a high ceiling, something like that. Just pick one up for $15 or $20. And they can extend to, you know, 15, 20 feet. And so I'm using it in two really interesting ways, because, you know, it's kind of a Y. It's not a normal screw attachment at the end of those paint poles, but it is standard. So there's a company that makes an adapter that goes from a painter's pole to a standard tripod socket. And so it is so cool, because you can put a flash up 20 feet if you want. Or, you know, and this was really useful for like the sports shoot where I wanted my assistants to hold those flashes way out over the water where she was diving into. No, problem solved. Put that flash on the end of the painter's pole. It's lightweight and it can extend 20 feet. So you can put that flash, I mean, anywhere you imagine. Another great spot is we were shooting on a bridge. The couple was standing on a footbridge, and I wanted that flash way out over the top of the bridge to shine light in them, just barely out of the frame. No problem. Put it on the extension pole and you can get that flash anywhere you want. Another cool way to use this is when you're shooting real estate, or if you want a really high perspective. A lot of guys are using drones. I have a drone to do photography with, but you can't use them commercially yet. And so this is perfect. You can attach your camera to this 20-foot extension pole, and 20 feet is really as high as you really want to go for a lot of real estate photography. Higher than that, and the photo and the house just kind of looks like a little, you know, Lego house or something. So it's actually really cool for a variety of situations, but especially with flash.
It seems like your camera bag is turning into a giant Swiss Army knife, and I love it.
It kind of is, because I use the AutoZone light in this shoot as well that I mentioned, the LED light stick thing that I mentioned in a previous doodad, and it was really cool.
That's awesome. And one thing that I've just kind of been obsessed with is astrophotography, as well as shooting pictures of the moon. And I was going to plug the iPhone doodad of the week for the Moon Phase Plus app, but let's go ahead and give some love to the Android users out there. There's the Phases of the Moon app free. It has a really high-end rating as far as user feedback. It's great, and it allows you to see the clarity of the moon based on your position with GPS. It shows you the phase of the moon, how close you are to a full moon, waning gibbous, whether it's a crescent, and what time of the night the moon is going to be in a certain part of the sky. So I definitely recommend my dude out of the week is the Phases of the Moon free app for Android. I am an iPhone user, and so is Jim, as we all know, but I thought I'd give some love to the Android users because this seems like a pretty solid app.
Very cool. That's an awesome doodad. I can use that all the time. Well, thank you everybody for your download and for supporting Improve Photography. We are just always delighted to be here on the podcast and share what we're learning in photography with you. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you in a couple days.
Thanks.